My name's Paul Bestall. This is Mysteries and Monsters on the Paranormal UK Radio Network. Welcome to this week's Mysteries and Monsters. Today, I'm joined by British Fortean Stu Neville, and we dive into the wide world of Fortiana. Stu has run the Fortean Times message boards for the last 20 years and still maintains them. In this conversation, we cover a whole range of phenomena, from Peter Underwood and Dennis Wheatley to Bigfoot, Nessie, ufology, poltergeists, Rendlesham, and much, much more. It's a pretty packed 80 minutes, so I hope you enjoy where our Fortean conversation takes us. Okay, so I've had a few emails from people just saying, hoping I'm okay, which I am, thankfully. Me and my family are very safe and well, and we're all adhering to social distancing, and checking if the show's going to continue. So I can categorically tell you, God willing, as long as I'm fit and able, this show will keep on moving. I've got the next 10 episodes done. Okay? So, we're going to be covering a wide range of topics with some brand new guests and a couple of well-loved previous guests returning once again. So, I hope you enjoy what I've got in store for you all. Don't forget, you can follow us on Facebook. We're on Twitter and Instagram as Mystery Monsters, and you can keep donating to the show via PayPal by also searching for Mystery Monsters on there too. Don't forget, you can always drop us a line as well via mysteriesandmonsters@gmail.com with any feedback, and please keep those lovely reviews coming. Appreciate anybody that does a review for me. It means the world to me, so thank you. Right, take care, stay safe, and let Mysteries and Monsters keep you entertained as the lockdown continues with our latest interview with Stu Neville. Stu Neville is a lifelong aficionado of the peculiar. He has written for the Fortean Times, is an active member of the paranormal research community, and since 2002 has been first a moderator and now an administrator for the Fortean Forums, which until the end of 2018 was the Fortean Times message boards. This has given him a unique vantage point to observe trends and attitudes in Fortean thought and the paranormal in general over the last 20 years. Stu, we're delighted to welcome you to Mysteries and Monsters. How are we?
Very well, thank you, sir. I'm delighted to be here.
Our pleasure to have you. We're big fans, obviously, as the Fortean Times on this show. I'm still waiting for that email to thank us for every time we mentioned them. But we'll see how we go. We were just having a brief chat off air because I think, especially for us who are attracted to the world of the weird and the paranormal, the Fortean Times is usually our gateway into this world. So what was the event or the story or the situation that created your interest into all this weirdness that we dive into, Stu?
Do you know what? I can't really remember. I've always been, as long as I've been conscious of it, I've always been really fascinated. I think it was ghosts, first of all. I had a real thing about ghosts, especially when I was a very small child, like 3 or 4. I had a real thing about them. But I was fascinated. I wasn't scared of them. Mm. I loved stories, but I was just really interested in it. And I wasn't kind of, oh, my God, you know, I want this because I want the fear reflex thing. Yeah. I just really wanted to hear the stories. And I was well into it. And kind of part of my brain just accepted it as normal part of life. And I became quite disappointed when I didn't start seeing ghosts all the time, which is a bit sort of sixth sense, I know, but we can move on. But then it kind of expanded, I think. I started reading quite a lot around 6, 7, I suppose. And I started getting a lot of the, there was a lot of the kind of unexplained books around, and wasn't it, for kids especially, like the Pan Book of the Unexplained and stuff. And it start, I started reading about UFOs. I started reading about cryptozoology. I didn't know it was called that. It was just called Monsters in those days, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah.
Monsters. So it was about monsters, and it was about fairies, and it was about people disappearing. And I started, it kind of expanded my interest in it then. Mm. And then by the time then I saw the World About Us when I was about eight, which I write about in the Patty piece. And I saw it, and I was ready, because I'd heard about the Abominable Snowman, and I was absolutely fascinated in the Abominable Snowman.
Yeah.
And I hadn't heard of anything else. And then there was this World About Us about 1975, and it showed the Shipton Prince and all the usual stuff, and people in parkas looking, you know, rugged and looking up towards mountains. And as Don, remember Don Willans?
Yes.
Don Willans, fantastic, because he had that Brummy accent or whatever it was, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And it's sort of like, and he said, Yeti coming, sob. And I looked out, and there was a Yeti over the hill. And it was kind of like, so matter of fact about it. You know, yeah. Bloody hell, it's like, that was a Yeti over there. Oh, that was it. Anyway, so then we came down the mountain. I can't say.
Yeah.
And it was like that. Suddenly, in the same world about us, they suddenly did a thing. It just sort of started showing the west coast of America and trees and what have you. And then it showed the Patty film, and I was about eight, and I was transfixed. Absolutely. Mm. That was it. I kind of, it did something to my eight-year-old brain, and it's just been there ever since. And I don't know what it is. I'm still interested in all the other stuff, but cryptozoology is the one that's really gripped me. That and ghosts, probably. So, yeah, so it's been a lifelong thing, a very long answer to a very short question.
That's all right. No, that's good, because, I think for me, out of all the fields, I'm like you, Stu, I think cryptozoology is the one that has my heart. As much as I'm really interested in ufology and the paranormal, though I am, at the moment, I'm going through a bit of a ghost addiction. I've started getting a load of Peter Underwood's old books.
Yeah.
And reading some of them for the first time in like 35 years or so, and it's wonderful just to take a step back in time, because he was like the master storyteller and collector of wonderful ghost stories from around the UK.
Was, unfortunately, there was a big, as is often the way with paranormal, because he was the president of the Ghost Club, wasn't he?
Yes.
And there was a big sort of falling out, as there often is in these kind of societies. The ego clashes are huge quite often, and they just end up falling apart, which unfortunately did with Underwood, because he's a very, very, very interesting writer, and he's very lucid, very knowledgeable, but then he fell out with the rest of the ghost hunting community, didn't he? And it sort of, you wonder how much more could have come out of it had he carried on talking to the rest of them, or the rest of them carried on talking to him.
Yeah.
But the stuff that left, like, I mean, Haunted London, I had an old library copy of that, which I bought when I was about 12, I think, from our local library. My local branch closed, and they sold off most of their stock. And I probably got out Haunted London more than anybody else ever.
Yeah.
Most of the stuff in there were me.
Yeah.
You know, I'll get back, I'll get stamped, I'll take it back out again the following week.
Yeah.
Anyway, and I bought it for about 40p. And I had it until very, very recently. It just fell apart. But it's a brilliantly well-written book, because it gives enough detail but doesn't go ludicrously over the top with it, you know? And there's the other one I've got, which is, Haunted Britain, which was Anthony Hipsley Cox, lovely name, which I've several copies of. But again, it goes into enough detail without swamping you. It doesn't have its pet subjects. It's quite, you know, it's quite broad in its approach. And I really like that. And it's something I try to do when I'm writing about it. You can get too bogged down in details. You have to keep the whole picture in sight, don't you?
Absolutely. I mean, I had the pleasure of speaking with Richard Astep the other week. And it was him that made me aware that Underwood's about to have a bit of a rebirth, as it were, because I think the family have finally agreed a deal to put all his work on Kindle.
Oh, good. Good.
Which I think's long overdue. And it's interesting that you refer to the famous falling out in the Ghost Club, because you may agree with me, Stu, you may disagree. I find it incredible in this day and age that unless you're around our generation, most people have no idea who Peter Underwood is.
No, you're quite right. It's but then again, a lot of our generation don't know who Dennis Wheatley was.
Oh,
and a lot. It's that. You know, he he did more to sort of like bring the idea of magic into the public consciousness than anyone else, pretty much.
Yes.
You know, we touched on it. So, I mean, you know, you get the casting of the runes, et cetera, which really alludes to it. And there's an awful lot of that there, with, you know, and a lot of the old ghost stories, especially M.R. James, make a lot of references to it. Yeah. But Wheatley was the first one who explicitly said, this is what it's about. This is, you know, demonology, da-da-da-da-da. Mm. And that people's entire knowledge of it was like, witches, Aleister Crowley, that's it. And it's some weird arcane thing. Mm. But you're right with the ghost thing. Yes, Peter Underwood was such an amazingly influential person. And his knowledge was absolutely peerless, wasn't it? He knew so much. And he wrote so engagingly. Mm. And this is often a problem we've got. It's something we can touch on later on, if you like. Mm. Which is when you've got individual testimonies or individual analyses of stuff. Mm. And it depends on the articulacy of the writer. Mm. So they can have something absolutely amazing to tell. But if they can't actually articulate that properly, it's just going to get lost. Yeah. And people aren't going to realize the significance of it, you know? But that's something we can come back to. But I think Underwood had the perfect balance, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's frustrating, I think, as well, when he, especially with Underwood, because he's got such a body of work as well. The amount of holidays him and his wife must have gone on, because he always seemed to be on holiday, and he goes, oh, right, I've been to the Yorkshire Dales, and it basically comes back with a book.
Yeah.
Essentially, how long's he away for?
I think he probably got to the point, because he sold so well, it got to the point probably where the publisher went, right then, where do you want to go now? Well, will you pay for me to go to the Yorkshire Dales? Yeah, go on then, off you go to the Yorkshire Dales. So his holidays were probably busman's jobs. Yeah. But, you know, it's more a travel writer who just happened to write about ghosts. You know, that way.
I'm just picking through. I've just, like I say, I'm really buying back into the reading some of these wonderful old ghost books. And I'm currently just restarted reading his Gazetteer's Guide to Ghosts and Spirits, which is very amusing, especially some of the older stories that have completely disappeared. I've just finished the chapter on haunted airports, which is brilliant.
Yes. There's some amazing stuff, you know, and a lot of this would be lost completely. I mean, I think a lot of people are quite lazy, and they will rely entirely on the internet for everything. Yes. Not everything's on the internet. You know, and this is the thing, because I mean, I've been chatting a lot with Dr. Paul Lee. You know, Paul's got his ghost tours app, and he's been trying to populate it as best as he can.
Yeah.
And he's just asking people, yeah, what do you know about local ghosts? You know, because unless you've got the books, they ain't going to be on the internet. Nobody knows about it, unless, especially with things like pubs and hotels, a lot of them will publicise the fact they've got a ghost. But other than that, you ain't going to care about it. You know, there's all kinds of local stuff going on. Yeah. And these books are an absolute goldmine for it, you know.
Absolutely. I mean, it's interesting you touched on Wheatley there. Strangely enough, as a child, my stepfather had the entire collection, leather-bound. We've still got them in red leather as well, which I think is appropriate for Wheatley's work.
Oh, so, yes.
Absolutely. And so by the time I was 11 or 12, I'd read, obviously my two favourites are The Devil's Rides Out and The Wonderful Haunting of Toby Jug, which I think is one of the most underrated horror stories of all time.
Yes, he could do subtle. That's the thing. I think people tend to, I think, again, in the popular consciousness, he's associated an awful lot with the Hammer versions of what he did.
Yes.
You know, so it's all about, you know, Charles Grey looking demonic and all this kind of stuff, and it's all the black masses, and it's Christopher Lee, and it's Nastasia Kinski in the buff, and all that kind of stuff. And actually, a lot of his stuff was very solemn. The card of Gifford Hillary, was that him? That was,
yes,
wasn't it?
Yes.
That's a really, really subtle, low key thing, you know. Yeah. And a lot of you watch the films, actually take away the more exploitative bits, and it does actually capture the mood of Wheatley quite well. Mm. You know, my favourite image of all is as Denham Elliot sat in an armchair in the middle of a pentangle.
Yes.
Because he's that terrified of going beyond it.
Yeah.
And a good enough actor like Denham Elliot can really sort of convey that. It's somebody, it doesn't matter whether it's real or not, he believes it, and that's all that matters. Yeah. You know, and that's something else we can come back to, you know.
Yeah. I mean,
belief is everything.
Absolutely. I mean, it always reminded me in regards to the way that M.R. James approached the subject, because he was a very brooding, building writer. He would just take you gently along, and then the next thing you just go, oh, terrifying. Yeah. You'd be like, oh, thanks for that.
Exactly. So it's the equivalent of the double jump you get in films now, isn't it?
Yes.
You know, he actually did that on the page. It's like, you know, a case of, oh, there's something in there, something coming in there, something, oh, it's all right, it's only the cat. And then suddenly somebody leaps out of the cupboard at you. It's that kind of thing. But he manages to do it on the page, which takes a lot of doing. Absolutely. Amazing.
Yeah, very much so. So in regards to yourself as a writer, you touched on it, your most notable recent article for the 14 Times, which was celebrating everyone's favourite cinematic cryptid, Patty, as she reached the grand old age of 50.
She did, yes.
I'm like you, Stu, I saw it a few years after you. I saw it on Arthur C. Clarke's Mysterious World.
Yeah, that's the second time I saw it.
And for me, that was my moment, and I just went, blimey.
Yeah.
This can't be real, surely to God. And yeah, after no. that was it. Cryptozoology bit me on the backside.
Yeah, absolutely. There's something about it, isn't there? Everybody I know who's seen Patty, because I mean, in those days, this is something else a lot of people don't appreciate. In those days, the only time you would ever see it in this country was if it appeared on the television.
Yes.
And that's it. And you had no control over that. There was no streaming, no nothing. Three channels, as we all know. Mm. God, we're going back now. You know, that was it. It was on the World of Bounties in 1975, then again on Arthur C. Clarke in 1980-81, maybe.
Yeah.
And that was the second time I ever saw it. Mm. And I bought books in the meantime, which would show stills, particularly yes. the turn frame, 267 or whatever it is, the one that turns and looks at the camera. Mm. That is the most famous still of the lot, obviously, of the entire film. But there's a lot more of the film than we tend to see anyway. It's a whole minute long.
Yes.
You only ever see 30 seconds of it. Because at the very end, you see it just kind of going off into the woods. Mm. And you've got to really strain to see it, sort of thing. But you're right. The first time you see it, it just hits something, doesn't it? It's kind of like... And there's another Bigfoot-related thing to that, which is when you hear Sierra sounds
yes.
or samurai chatter for the first time. I'm a big bloke, you know, I was sort of this rugby playing, drinking, yeah, whatever. The first time I ever heard it, Sierra sounds, I was sat, believe it or not, at home alone.
Yeah.
And I was just like watching something on TV and there was something about before. Okay, great, I'll watch this. And they started playing some samurai chatter. And I'm not kidding. I sat there and what the hell is that?
Yeah.
I got to the point I nearly got to put the light on. Yeah. Just light yes. on. I'm not going to sit. I'm going to sit here all night. It did something to me. It freaked the hell out of me. And I think that's possibly a memory of what Patty.
Mm.
The first time I saw it, because it fascinated me, but it half terrified me in a way, in a funny way. Mm. And I don't know how, but it did.
Yeah.
You know.
Absolutely. I mean, I've been lucky enough to speak to Ron Moorhead. Who recorded the Sierra sounds, and he's an absolute gent. And he sent me some of his recordings to use in the show, which I was just stunned by. You know, such a generous offer of him. And I like the same as you. I don't think I'd heard those till about late 90s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's about mid late 90s. Yeah,
and it just like you, there was a shiver ran up my spine, and I thought, well, if that's what she sounds like, I don't want to meet her anymore.
Exactly. It's it's just you're dead right. That's the thing. It's like, is it some sort of? I mean, let's for one second assume they're real. Okay,
yes.
I'm not saying they're real. I just know there is a sound that we can't really explain. Assuming it's real.
Yep.
It's a very, it's a known sort of physiological thing that some animals do, isn't it?
Yep.
It's like they know that tigers have got a two-tone roar, haven't they?
Yeah.
So they do that subsonic roar that you can't hear, but you can feel.
Yeah.
And it stuns things. Things stop. What the hell is that? And then it roars.
Yeah.
Because they're put off guard. And I wonder if it's some similar thing. It's something which vibrates within us that sets off. Because it can be very, very territorial and very, very intimidating, as we know. You know, chucking rocks, trees, bits of car at people, etc.
Yeah.
You know, we wonder if this is the first warning. It's a specific way that they speak, for want of a better word, to put us off. They know we're there and they're putting us off, you know.
Yeah,
could
absolutely.
Be.
I mean, I've noticed over the last sort of 5 or 10 years, you know, and touched on about trend spotting and things like that. I've noticed a lot of people have started gravitating towards the infrasound in regards to Bigfoot or Sasquatch in regards to, because for a lot of the, you know, the really good witness encounters, there's always this concept of feeling afraid for no reason from really experienced outdoorsmen and hunters and people who spend the majority of their time deep in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
Who inexplicably, after 30 years, all of a sudden get this overwhelming sense of fear, and then they have an experience. I find those stories in particularly the most compelling for me, I think.
They're the most convincing because it's people who know what they're looking at. They know what they're listening to. You know, it's like when cops and soldiers, you know, or park rangers, especially in the States, they see things all the damn time. They know what a bear looks like. You know, they know what a moose sounds like. They don't mistake one for the other. You know what I mean? They're not going to go, oh, that thing walking onto you, that's a bear. They know what a bloody bear looks like.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of them, especially the cops and the soldiers and stuff like that, they're risking a great deal of ridicule by coming out and saying stuff.
Mm.
You know, some of them risk their jobs. I mean, there's something called Paranormal Witness, the TV show. Have you seen that? The Watcher in the Woods, I think it is. Yeah, the guy in the Cascades. And he's a cop and he's an ex-Marine. He's freaked out by it, comes down, says to the sheriff, I've seen this. The sheriff says, yeah, don't worry about it. And that's it. It happens all the time. Just don't even go there. Forget it. You know? So the sheriff, you know what I mean? It's just kind of, look, just don't bother, mate. We know. You know, it's one a case of we don't believe you. It's a case of, yeah, I know. Just don't bother. We know. Leave it alone. Yeah. You know what I mean? So it's got, I mean, back to the Patty film, you know, this is why it's so, I think, so compelling, because it's there's something about it, isn't there? There's something about it.
Yeah, I mean, for me, the other aspect of this is, you know, I'm not trying to make myself out to be any kind of film critic, but, you know, I've watched every bad film ever made, I suspect, especially from the 50s and 60s. And I've seen near enough every good film made as well. I don't just, you know... Other than my addiction to Mystery Science Theatre 3000, I've also taken in some wonderful works of cinema over the years. I have seen some tosh. And the thing that I've always found most frustrating about this is that people go, oh, yeah, it's clearly a man in a suit. You know, it's Hollywood. I've seen a lot of bad movie monster films. I've seen a lot of good monster films. There's nothing comparable at that time, even by a big studio.
No. Yeah, John Stevens himself said, you know, his actual words were, in fact, I think I put it in the article I did, didn't I? He said at the time, whoever made that's as good as I am, you know, and that was it. He just said, look, mate, if you can do that, I can only just do that. And in fact, there's bits of it he couldn't do.
Yeah,
you know, it's the bloke who did the Planet of the Apes, for God's sake.
Yeah, which came out the year after.
Exactly, you know. He said it would. I mean, he did say, "Look, if it is a suit, it'll have to be tailor-made by someone as good as me with a hell of a budget."
Yeah,
you know, because there's that guy in North Carolina, Philip Morris.
Yes.
Who said, "Oh yeah, I made it for a joke."
Yeah.
So National Geographic said, "Okay, here's 100 grand. Make another one." I'm sorry. I've got to go to the dentist.
Yeah.
And then I'm going on. Hang on. Wait a minute. And they never heard anything from him again. It's kind of like, well, no, you didn't, mate. You know, if it's a costume, it's an incredible one, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, that's the interesting thing as well, because I've seen that still used today as a complete dismissal of the whole situation. It's either hoaxes, which I've always found baffling, because I know Ivan Sanderson often said, you know, if I find a set of footprints in British Columbia where nobody's been for 5 weeks, they have to work on the principle that a hoaxer has gone into the middle of nowhere, hoping on the off chance that A, it's not going to snow anymore.
Yeah.
And B, some silly bugger's going to come wandering past.
Well, exactly. Although it's not going to thaw even. You know what I mean? It's complete. Yeah, exactly. Well, I touched on that. I mean, because the thing is with Patty, if you accept it was just him and Gimlin, just Patterson and Gimlin, then there's only four possibilities. If you boil it down, I took it to kind of philosophical levels, really.
Yes.
There are only four possibilities, and it's either, basically, number one, it's a hoax, okay? And both Patterson and Gimlin were complicit with it.
Yep.
So Gimlin has been lying for 50 years saying, I saw a creature, right? Gimlin has never diverged from that.
No,
he hasn't said a lot more. But he comes over sincere. Everybody's interviewed him. He says, look, I saw a creature. It wasn't a bear. It wasn't a man. We saw this. This is what happened. And he's never, ever gone off that.
Yeah.
All right. Then that's the first possibility. The other possibility is number two. It was a hoax, which was arranged by Patterson, and Gimlin was the fall guy. He didn't, you know.
Yeah.
But there's still all kinds of problems with that. You know, we'll come to it in a moment. The third possibility was a hoax, and they were both duped, so somebody pranked both of them.
Yep.
But as you said, that comes back to De Hinden's point. You know, how the hell did somebody know they were going to come around that corner at that moment?
Yep.
So that they could pretend, you know, two armed guys.
Well, it's like, exactly.
You know, come on. I mean, okay, Patterson has said don't shoot it, which is a problem. We'll come back to that one. But again, it implies that Gimlin certainly wasn't complicit to any form of hoax. Mm. And the fourth possibility, which is the one which a lot of people have a problem with, is that it's not a hoax at all and it was an actual creature that they filmed.
Yeah.
You know, that's option four, and it's got to be made on the table. You know.
I mean, that's the thing as well, because obviously Patterson's family, because people say this, oh, Patterson admitted it was a hoax at the end. As far as I'm aware, we have one report that a member of his family said on his deathbed he confessed they'd made it all up, and that was
it. But just the one, isn't it?
And everybody goes, oh, right, he's right, everybody else is wrong. Like you say, Bob Gimlin's been lying. As you refer to there, Stu, that's the interesting thing about Bob's story. Is with the greatest respect, and I'm sure we can both think of countless examples of this particular exaggeration that becomes through the overtelling of a story. And then a prime example is Rendlesham, where everybody involved in it now had mind control, and we've got binary codes and symbols and everything. 40 years ago, nothing.
No, exactly. I mean, I've seen everything up as far as a Wilhelm Reich cloudbuster being involved in Rendlesham. You know, and it's kind of, well, for God's sake. And it's just extrapolating upon extrapolation, isn't it?
Yes.
And which is very non-Occam, I might add. You know what I mean? Yeah. You take a theory, but you can't base another theory on top of a theory that you haven't proved yet. Absolutely. You know, that's what a lot of these things do. They telescope out. Interestingly, we're having a conversation about Timothy Good earlier on on Facebook. I don't know if you've seen it.
Yes, I was part of it, because I was telling Steve off for thinking he was dead.
Ah, right. No, I'm looking at this morning. Yeah, exactly. I mean, as I say on there, the problem is he's got some fundamentally good, not evidence. Evidence is the wrong word. Mm. But he's got some good bases that he looks at. Yeah. But then Good kind of started spotting patterns. He gets carried away. And a lot of them do that. I think this is part of the problem, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, they've got a fundamentally good idea. Like Above Top Secret was actually not too bad a book.
Mm.
But then every subsequent one has basically taken Above Top Secret was completely true, and therefore this must be true as an extension of it. And then the next one must be true because the first two were true. You know what I mean? And unfortunately, it doesn't work like that. You've got to stay on solid ground as much as you possibly can. You know.
Yeah, I mean, Timothy Good's an interesting point as well, because he's one of those guys that I didn't sound kind of catch him when he was riding the zeitgeist in the '90s. And he's someone I've kind of been, because like I say, I kind of drifted away from ufology in the early noughties and didn't come back into it till about 2 or 3 years ago through a couple of podcasts that I follow religiously now. And
but interesting, that follows the pattern, because the UFOs were huge in the 90s.
By the end
of the 90s, people had had enough of them. You know, we obviously, the high point was probably the alien autopsy. And then the X-Files was reflecting all this, and it was all very much a bubble. And then that kind of burst.
Mm.
And then the ghosts came along. The ghosts supplanted it for all of the noughties. It was all about Most Haunted, all about ghosts, da-da-da-da-da. Then come 2010, then it was back to cryptozoology again, and, you know, and finding Bigfoot, et cetera, et cetera. So it's interesting how that was, because a lot of people, me included, I'd had enough of UFOs by about 1999. I'd just had enough of them.
Yeah.
I was just, every time I saw even FT articles on UFOs, I'd say, oh, sod this, can't be bothered.
I must admit, every time I saw something I watched anything, Stu, at that period, I was like, oh, not Roswell again. Oh, Rendlesham, no.
No, for God's sake.
Are these the only two cases ever?
Exactly. There's so many of the bloody things. Yeah, why not talk about Lolly Zamora? You know, talk about something like that.
Oh, the
something
Westall incident in Australia, which is incredible.
There is some amazing stuff. Or the flight from the New Zealand flight that New Year's Eve.
Yes.
Quentin, I remember the reporter's name, Quentin Fogarty. You don't forget it, like Fogarty.
Yeah.
But they filmed it from a plane, tracking the planet. That wasn't Venus. Venus was the other side. You know what I mean? The moon was below the horizon.
Yeah.
That was something else.
That's
and they filmed it.
Sorry, Stu. I was going to say that incident has one of my best, or one of the sceptical explanations that makes me laugh the most.
I
remember Quentin being interviewed after they'd filmed these very strange lights. That apparently they were told it was the moon reflecting off cabbages.
I love it.
By the New Zealand Air Force.
Oh, God. One of my favourite things is unlikely explanations.
Yes.
I love the best. I mean, sometimes, especially when they're far more unlikely than the actual thing that they purport to be.
Yes.
So, like, my favourite Nessie one of all time is that it's carp swimming in formation. For the name of God. Yes, well, and I actually spoke to someone about this, right? I mean, it was in the Daily Mirror or something. It's carp swimming in formation. I said, do you think carp swim in formation? Well, obviously they do. No, obviously they do. I said, what makes it, why is that more likely than it being a Loch Ness Monster? So, well, the Loch Ness Monster doesn't exist. We know that carp exist. I said, what's that? You can't argue with that kind of mentality.
You can't. I mean, that's another good point as well, because obviously at the minute in the UK, we're a bit behind the States. Apologies to the majority of my listeners who are in America, who have probably seen the entire season. But obviously we've got In Search of Us returned. Mm. And I don't know if you've caught this second season that started about 4 weeks ago in the UK.
But no, I've got a huge backlog of stuff to watch, unfortunately.
But the first double episode was about Nessie. And I was blown away in the second episode because basically they were explaining that the Stronachie beast had never been identified and it was a mysterious monster. And they'd got a biologist on who was basically saying, yeah, it's a completely unknown animal. And I was like,
shark, wasn't it?
1986, it's a basking shark. They've got the vertebrae. And they're like, no, it's never been identified. Is this a plesiosaur? And I'm thinking, it's 2020, you know, with the greatest respect. And we're still perpetuating nonsense as fact. And people, instead of using Google and going, well, let me just check that. Because if I see anything that I think, well, I you know, I'm saying I'm an expert on everything, Stu. I'm sure you do. Anybody of a 40 and slant does who knows about certain cases.
Yeah.
You just go straight online and you go, hang on a minute. That's nonsense. And I was absolutely stunned in this day and age that that's still being put forward.
It is, unfortunately. There's a lot of agenda-driven stuff, isn't there? And this is one of the problems, I think, is that there's a very distinct mindset that, you know, this is a mystery. And it's something you see on the forums quite a lot when you get the it happened to me sort of like idea. Because obviously it's just the mag itself. And in the old days, I mean, it hasn't been up for a long time. It used to be a direct vector then. We had a separate account called It Happened to Me. And if people wrote in, if it did make the mag, often it's not... they'd give it to us and we'd just put it as it happened to me. And then people would discuss it. And what you'd end up with is that quite often you'd get people who turn up and say, okay, this happened to me. And then being the 14 times we would take it apart respectfully, very respectfully, ask lots of questions, establish the proper context, because context is absolutely everything in 14ism.
Yeah.
You know, properly establish what happened. And occasionally you come up with a genuinely good explanation. You'd say, right, well, in this case, it could well be this. Here's the proof. Here's some write-up. Similar stuff has happened before. Are you in this kind of situation? And then sometimes you get people go, oh, right, yeah, there's one of those over the road. Got it. Lovely. That explains everything. Thank you very much. What you'd equally get, however, is people going, no, I saw so-and-so, and that's it. And how dare you doubt me?
Yeah.
I said, well, you know, what have you asked us for then? It's like... You know, sort of, there's this particular idea that 14ism is a bastion of credulity. But equally, there's one that it's a bastion of scepticism.
Yes.
And it's not either. The thing is, everything is entirely context based.
Yeah.
And this is something I'll try to get over to people, is that just because one thing is proved to be fake, it doesn't mean that the next thing that's reported is also a fake. Mm. You know, you have to take in the circumstances which prove the first one is fake, no problem at all. Yeah. Apply the same optics to it every single time. Not a problem with that, but you can't immediately dismiss one because the other one wasn't true. They've got to be seen in isolation as well as collectively.
Absolutely.
And I think this is part of the thing. You know, come back to In Search Of, you're right, there's this very strong agenda about this is a mystery and this is a mystery. And it's one of the reasons I used to very much enjoy Monster Hunter, or what was it called over here? Destination, whatever it was.
Josh Gates.
Yes, Josh Gates. Whatever it was.
Destination Truth.
Destination Truth, that's it. And he was always very honest. And that's what I've always liked about Josh Gates.
Yes.
If Josh, you know, I don't know if you saw one of the very first ones when they were in the Himalayas and they filmed a bipedal figure going up a crag.
Yeah.
And they filmed it in infrared. And then they said, literally 10 minutes later, we found out that was one of the bearers going up to the base camp.
Yeah.
So it wasn't a Yeti, it was one of the bearers. And totally honest about that. Now, if that had been finding Bigfoot, it'd be a case of, look at this, and that's it. They wouldn't mention it again. They'd just say, look at this, it's a figure. You know, and there was a famous ending to finding Bigfoot, which Matt Moneymaker himself actually explained after a while. There was a figure stood rigidly in a field, and Bobo Fay approached it, and it said, what is it? It's not moving. And he approached it, and it cut off, and they never mentioned it again.
Yeah.
And he said that in the edit, it was actually it was a horse.
Yeah.
You know, and it was a tethered horse.
Mm.
And it was tethered, and they found that out, but they never mentioned that again because they had to dramatise it so much.
Yes.
And this is irritating to a lot of people about finding Bigfoot because they don't explain stuff. We're all grown-ups. We all want this to kind of come up with a resolution, you know, and it's much better if they go, actually, no, that wasn't, but we looked at it, you know? Mm. That's what we want from them, really, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, very much so. I mean, it's interesting, like you touch on there about the automatic dismissal after that. Enfield is a prime example of that because Gross and Playfair admitted that they caught the two girls mucking about.
Yeah.
So automatically, and I've seen this recently on the 40 and Times Facebook page, people said, they completely dismissed it, Playfair and Gross. And I was like, they've never said that ever. They admitted that they caught them. However, that doesn't disprove the other, what was it, 1,500 incidents?
Yeah, tons of them, wasn't there? And that was over a long period of time.
Police.
And exactly. It's, you know, they weren't trying to fool toddlers. You know, these were professional people, and they did. It's. I mean, the thing is, it's very. This is something I've made quite a lot of over the years.
Mm.
I mean, one of the earliest examples is actually Cottingley.
Yes.
So the Cottingley fairies, you get, you know, fight. You look at it now; it's obviously fair. You know, pictures stuck on a pier.
Yeah.
But you get the likes of Conan Doyle turning up.
Yeah.
You know, so say the foremost logical mind of his generation.
Mm.
Look, it's fairies. But he really, really needed to believe.
Yeah.
You know, that's the point with Conan Doyle. He absolutely needed to believe that there was an afterlife, that there was that there were fae, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It was very important to him, to his own personal integrity, to believe that.
Yeah.
And so he would seize upon anything, regardless. But ultimately, Elsie said, no, we did see fairies. It's because people didn't believe us. That's why we faked the photographs, to make people believe that we'd seen it.
Yeah.
And to her, they said, no, we did see them. They were there.
Yeah, I remember. You know? I remember seeing her where they basically, I'm sure, once again, I think people must get sick of me mentioning Arthur C. Clarke's Mysterious World. But that's the first time I ever saw them. And that's exactly what they said. They said, oh, yeah, well, we had to fake the photos because everybody was taking the Michael out of them.
Yeah,
so we did it.
Exactly.
But then that all opened a different can of worms because obviously the forensic examination proved that they'd really been sharpened up and nobody knew. They knew the girls couldn't be responsible for this. So was it the family? Was it the first person they gave the kit? Because I think I've forgotten who they gave it to, who got them out into the world. And then that's when they came to Conan Doyle's attention, didn't they?
It was. You're right. Somebody else got. Yeah, there was a journalist or something got involved, didn't they? And they sort of got Conan Doyle onto it. But this is part another thing, you see, because you get these people who are very, very big in the fields. The best example of the lot is Harry Price.
Yes.
Harry Price absolutely, solidly believed in ghosts and poltergeists. Absolutely, not a shadow of a doubt.
Mm.
Unfortunately, because he wanted people to believe, he was not above helping it along.
Yes.
You know, and he would, like the Enfield girls, he would make stuff happen.
Yeah.
To make other people believe. So it was coming from a good place. It wasn't necessarily from an outright mendacious place.
Yeah.
But it was coming because he really wanted. And I think George Adamski was another one like that. George Adamski, something probably did happen to George Adamski.
Mm.
But then he built a whole world around it
yes.
to make people believe in it, you know. And I don't think money was necessarily the motivator. No. Billy Mayer was a proper faker. Billy Mayer chucked hubcaps up in the...
Welcome to Kraken Mare, the biggest liquid hydrocarbon ocean on Saturn's moon Titan.
And this is just one of the places you get to visit and learn about when you listen to the Hostile Worlds podcast.
The Hostile Worlds podcast, which is, of course, a science-based audio drama documentary series that teaches you all about our universe in a fun and entertaining way.
Head on over to hostileworlds.net to subscribe on your podcast app of choice.
One arm, he did amazingly, really chucking up gaff and then taking a photograph. I don't know how he did it. Probably best not dwell on that, frankly, but there we go. Anyway, he was in it for the cash. But Damski, etc., I didn't think he was. I think he really believed, but he wanted other people to believe so much that he would not. And perhaps Roger Patterson falls into that category to a degree. It could be, you know, he absolutely did believe in Bigfoot. Come back to the Patty film. My God, we've been around the world since. But Patty film. He there's all the usual stuff. He wanted to get film of Bigfoot. He was going to make a Bigfoot film anyway. He'd done sketches of Bigfoot, which actually match pretty much what you then see in the film, et cetera, et cetera. But then you get the other side, which is that such a really... such a good suit that nobody can spot. Even now with computer enhancement, you still can't see his zip, you know. Yes. But then if you look on the 14 forums, he said, publicising it again, look on there. There's a huge, huge thread on the Patterson film, full of people who know what they're talking about, and occasionally me going, well, the thing is, yeah, I know, but it's still fake. Why? Because Bigfoot doesn't exist. Yeah. Yes, okay. But here's a film of which purports to be it, and we can't prove that it's not. Yeah, you can't prove a negative. It's no, but Bigfoot doesn't exist. And it's this recursive argument, which is going to go round and round.
Yeah.
You know, until someone actually kills one.
Yes.
Or we get some explanation of it, which I'm kind of moving towards. You said about infrasound and stuff like that in our conversation earlier. And I'm coming towards infrasound and other... so wavelengths, there's possibly an explanation for some of these things, and ghosts and UFOs and God knows what else. It's not a theory of everything, per se, but I think it might explain some of them.
Yeah,
if that makes sense.
No, I agree, and I find it sometimes quite staggering because in my family's life, you know, we had people who, you know, doctors of chemistry and physics, so. My interpretation of the world of science was that to continually search for answers, and nothing is concrete unless we can repeat it and prove it. So yeah. I was often stunned when someone who I respect a great deal, Professor Brian Cox, said that the Large Hadron Collider proved that ghosts didn't exist, as though the Large Hadron Collider answered every question in the universe, which I just thought showed, not in regards to Brian Cox, but I just think that kind of attitude just shows staggering arrogance. That we understand everything at play in the universe, regardless of life on Earth.
This is part of the thing, isn't it? I mean, Brian Cox is a brilliant bloke, but he's an expert on astrophysics. Yeah. He's not necessarily an expert on what we're experts on. I'm not saying any of us are experts, because I've had a good friend of mine is a doctor of chemistry, and we've had various discussions. Well, it doesn't exist. Why? He's a scientist. That's his attitude. If you can't prove the science, then it doesn't exist. You know, so that's fine. I respect his attitude. He actually respects mine that I believe otherwise. You know, but I think there's two different problems here. For a start, as I said, it's the case of things should be proven on their own merit. Just because A is a fake doesn't mean B is a fake. You know? Also, it could be, and this is where I'm coming out from the other direction. I said about infrasound and about electromagnetic wavelengths and God knows what else. It could be that there are an awful lot of things which manifest in a similar way. So it could be, for example, if you take a random, ghost is probably the best example. If you take five random ghost reports, one could be a stone tape. One could be a projected memory from somebody, which in the right sort of conditions can be projected, like R2-D2 projects Princess Leia.
Yeah.
And the person then sees it. But that's the best way of describing it.
Yeah.
Another could be an electromagnetic wavelength, which the brain then interprets, like a radio, as being a ghostly figure. Mm. Another one could be an infrasound, which has a similar effect on the nervous system. Persinger proved this, didn't he? Persinger, when he's doing stuff with magnets around the brain, could make people see and feel all kinds of things.
Yeah.
You know. And the fifth one could be, again, I don't know, well, again, magnetic field fluctuations. You know, it could be affecting the brain. So there could be five separate, you know, they all manifest in a similar way, but it could be five totally separate causes for it.
Yeah.
And just to say, well, there's no such thing as ghosts, doesn't stop five people seeing something which manifests to them subjectively as a ghost.
Yeah.
And that's the point. Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've always found it interesting because, especially when there are well-known haunted locations and well-known ghosts, as you and I both know, the amount of white ladies that wander the UK is a staggering amount. If they're not white, they're usually grey.
Yes.
And I've always found that theory that it you know, as we know, the human brain is a very strange thing. People are genetically different on near enough every level, although we are all essentially the same on the outside. And the way the brain is wired up and the chemistry inside us, perhaps that's also the gateway that why only certain people see them. If you know, if there's 20 people on a tour of an old house somewhere and one person sees something, well, why is she seeing it and not the other 19?
Yeah. Is it that she's just tuned in?
Yeah.
Yep. Her brain is configured in that way that she's sensitive to those particular vibrations. Mm. If you look at it as a set of radios, and we're all on different stations, that it stops becoming some sort of weird, mystical, they got second sight. It just means they're tuned in a different way, and that's all it is, you know. And that could cover a whole range of things, you know. It makes me I think ghosts, and again, cryptids, it could be the same thing. It's just some people see cryptids, not because they're flesh and blood animals, which might explain why people can see a Bigfoot in the middle of Cannock Chase, for God's sake. I mean, British Bigfoot, and we've had this discussion a lot. And I love British, but I love them, bless them. There aren't any flesh and blood British Bigfoot. It doesn't. They just aren't. Yeah. You know, for God's sake. You know, I mean, look, if you've got an area the size of Alaska,
yeah,
right, with 11 people living in it,
yeah,
you know, then loads of things will be wandering around and nobody will be any the wiser. Your local park, if it had an 8-foot man beast in it, somebody would have spotted it by the end of the day. You can pretty much guarantee it, you know?
Yeah.
So it's not flesh and blood Bigfoot, though. But that doesn't mean people aren't seeing something their brain renders as an 8-foot hairy person.
Yeah,
and I've got no problem with that.
Absolutely.
You know?
I mean, one of the Tower of London's famous ghosts, is it a bear?
Yeah, a bear, yeah.
So if you can see the ghost of a 7-foot bear rearing up, why not see something?
Yeah. Bears were wild in Britain until the Middle Ages.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what stopped you seeing the ghost of a bear, which your brain, because of the environment in which we live, doesn't go, it's a bear. Mm. They think if it's rearing up, oh, look, it's on its back legs, it's 8 foot tall, and it's furry, therefore it's a Bigfoot.
Yeah.
You know, perhaps it's a ghost bear, and that's what you're seeing.
Yeah, strange, you know, things have happened.
yeah, precisely. If you're going to see it in the middle of London, you know. But it's this is something you've got to kind of bear in mind. And there's a lot of lessons about perception. If you look, a lot of the old philosophies are starting to come back in now, aren't they? So Buddhism and Stoicism and so forth. And they've got a lot to actually teach you about perceptions.
Yeah.
And most of them involve don't overcomplicate what you're looking at. Mm. And the same thing goes with Occam, because I think Occam has become kind of abused, hasn't it, over the years? Occam's razor, a lot of people use it as a shutdown technique. It's a case of, no, it can't exist because X doesn't exist, therefore you didn't see X.
Yeah.
Occam's razor, no, not Occam's razor. Occam's razor isn't the most simple explanation, is the best. It's part of Occam's razor, is that.
Yeah.
But part of it is, the main thing is, you can't base a hypothesis on an untested hypothesis. That's the main thing. It's the multiplication of entities. You know, you can't base thing upon something else you haven't proved, effectively. And the thing is, Stoicism and Buddhism both teach you, no, you don't know the surrounding things. You can only go on what you're observing. What you see is what you see. What you experience is what you experience. And you can't then build up a story that led up to it or a story leading after it. You can only really genuinely account for what you yourself saw in the moment. And that's all there is. Mm. You know, you can't guess. You don't know.
Yeah, I mean, that's always an interesting aspect of it as well. You know, I always find people who see animal ghosts quite interesting, because I'm surprised, Stu, people don't see more of them.
Yeah. Well, see, because was it Terence McKenna who came up with the idea? He said, you walk into a shopping centre, you don't know how many people you're looking at are ghosts.
Yes.
Before you know, 20% of them could be ghosts. Because you don't know each other, you don't know they're dead. Therefore, you don't know they're a ghost. You know, and it's kind of, I'm not saying he's right, but for all we know, a lot of the animals we see are ghosts.
You know,
how many animals do you interact with on any physical level? Mm. You know, you see birds flying about or whatever. How many of them do you actually hear sing? Mm. A lot of them fly silently. For all you know, are they there? Which goes deep. You know, it's quite abstruse philosophy.
Yes.
But again, if you want to take it to the Buddhist or the Stoic, that'd be their thing. You saw a bird. You know, was it a live bird, a dead bird? You know what I mean? Mm. You saw a bird. Oh, where's it gone? You've no idea where it's going. You know, what's having for tea? You don't know. You've just seen a bird. That's it. That's all you can say with any surety, you know?
Yeah.
So, who knows?
Well, I mean, you know, and obviously here in the UK, one of the birds that's most associated with the paranormal is the robin, because a lot of people tend to view a robin turning up in their garden as a portent of a visitation by a departed loved one, which I've always found quite a sweet explanation for one of our prettiest native birds.
Yeah, no, I agree with that, you know. And so on, like a white feather, and you've been visited by an angel and stuff like that. White feathers come from it. Funny enough, that happened to me the other day. I was literally sitting in the living room and a white feather landed on my lap, like from a pillow. No idea. It perhaps it did, but how the hell it got into our living room and just happened to land on my lap, I really have no idea. Yeah. And I might have been visited by an angel, but this is another thing. Perhaps I was visited by an angel and I have no idea. Perhaps the angel was the one who picked up my wallet when I dropped it at the post office queue the other day, which did happen just after that.
Yeah.
So perhaps that was the angel. You know what I mean? So who knows?
Well, very true. I'd like the answer, Stu, as to whenever I go out socialising in Sheffield's fine hostelries, I seem to pick up glitter. I don't know where it comes from. And like, I'll come back and say,
I have a relationship with glitter, which my friends will tell you about, which I'm not going to go into now. It's got the half-life of uranium glitter. It really has. We had a Christmas party, and for a laugh, one of my friends put glitter eyeshadow on me. Because, you know, all right, whatever, you know, it's a Christmas party, isn't it? And anyway, literally 3 weeks later, there was glitter in the sink when I was shaving. It's like, where the bloody hell is this coming from? And a week after that, I was in the newsagent, and the newsagent was looking at me in a funny way. I was like, somebody said, you've got glitter in your eyebrows. It's like, for God's sake, to this day, I found bits of glitter. It's like, for God's sake. This stuff's amazing, isn't it?
Yes.
Glitter. I must write about glitter. It's got some sort of the persistence of glitter or something similar to that. I don't know.
Absolutely. I think when nuclear waste finally decays away, it'll probably just leave a trail of glitter, I think.
Perhaps it is glitter. That's what it is. Glitter is actually nuclear byproduct from the, if you believe that we had a previous civilization before the dinosaurs, I reckon glitter is what's left of it. That's it, you see. It's the lowest possible. You can't go any lower than glitter. It's lower than subatomica. Glitter is indispensable. It's stardust. Yeah. Oh, God. Watch, how camp is that? It's stardust. Wonderful.
perhaps that's what Bob Lazar's actually discovered.
Yeah, you never know. Oh, God, Bob Lazar. Don't get me started on Bob Lazar. He's another one, you see. Bob Lazar, I don't know whether he's telling partly the truth.
Yes.
And then it's just become, he's had to go along with his own lie. Mm. Or whether he is a genuine, whether everything he says is genuine. And the CIA have done such a good job of discrediting him that nobody believes him now.
Yeah.
You know, because then you start getting to the conspiracy side of the things, isn't it? Which is, I mean, this is something I wrote about in the FT. Is conspiracies, you know, and the great thing about conspiracies, as opposed to all the other 14 disciplines, is conspiracy. The less evidence there is, the more people put credence in them, because it's a cover-up. And therefore, the less evidence, the better the cover-up. And if there's no evidence at all, then it's a really good cover-up. And that's what people think. And you cannot argue with conspiracy theorists. Yeah, it's just like, well, there's no evidence. Of course, there's no evidence. That's what they want you to think. It's like, well, no.
I mean, That is one of those perplexing things that you tend to find, I think, more often in ufology than anything, I think, Stu, that the absence of evidence proves that there's a cover-up. But then and like we touch on with Lazar is an incredible case, because every time I think I'm out of it, he says something else and I'm pulled back in, because there's just something going on there. But it's interesting, because I mentioned it earlier when we were saying when we both got sick of seeing UFOs in the late 90s. Rendlesham, John Burroughs. That gives real credence to a situation that something had happened, because obviously he ended up becoming extremely ill, which he blames on the incident.
Yes.
And so he wasn't eligible for medical insurance because allegedly he wasn't there at the time. And he ended up having to get John McCain involved, his senator, because I think he lives in Arizona now, Burroughs, to basically act on his behalf. And eventually they found out that his records had been suppressed and basically pushed to one side, which beggars the question, why on earth would they do that? Because that then, all of a sudden, after everything we say about Rendlesham and certain witnesses who have simply just inserted themselves in the story and will not give those people any more time than they've already stolen over the last 30 years, I think.
Warren Carf, etc.
I agree. That just gives the story a different slant entirely. That yes, he was there. Yes, they suppressed his records. Yes, he basically had to force them to release them. That's crazy.
It is fairly. I mean, the American military are pretty. As we all know, they're fairly paranoid anyway. Yes. They always have been. The British military are equally paranoid. You know, I think most militaries are. They really get prickly if people start looking into what they're doing. But I think the thing with Rendlesham, I mean, the top, I'm not going to say sceptical, the top rational explanation for Rendlesham is that a nuclear weapon was compromised, isn't it?
Yes.
That they either fell off the plane as they were coming to land. So it was in the forest. So they had to get the bloody thing back, which is totally credible. It has happened. I mean, it happened with the British, didn't it?
Yes.
We lost one over, was it Berwyn?
Yes.
There was certainly lost, in North Wales.
Yeah.
And it's one, it was a UFO flat. Well, no, I think that was a nuke that fell off a Vulcan, you know, and they had to close it off to bloody find the thing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that is a credible explanation, but they never said, one of our weapons was compromised. They've just shut up about it. You know, and it's one of those situations, like we were saying earlier, where if they'd just sort of put their hands up and gone, actually, this is what happened, everybody would go, okay, fine, that's all right. Except for the hardcore of ufologists who go, ha, that's a cover-up. It was a UFO. So, oh, God, here we go, you know what I mean? And they won't accept it. It's got its own momentum, though, hasn't it? Like Roswell, like Patterson, like Patty. It's got its own momentum. Even if stuff is proved absolutely, there will always be people who still believe it's a paranormal thing. You know, that's what you can't do anything about that.
Mm. I mean, that's the puzzling thing about it, because it would have been far easier for the US Air Force to just go, here you are.
Mm.
And by not doing it, they suddenly basically lit a fire back under the case, because it was one of them that seemed to drift away again. And then everybody got it, came back into fashion about 10 years ago. Then it went out again. And then the Burroughs situation occurred and it just came back again. And obviously, I think by October, I think everybody in the world is going to be sick of Rendlesham, because obviously it's the 40th anniversary this year, isn't it?
Yeah. But then again, you see, everybody thought Patterson was going to like blow up against it was the 50th, and it didn't. We kind of, I mean, I spoke to David Sucks. It took me, actually, believe it or not, it's only a 4,000 word thing. It started as a 7,000 word article, that one. It was going to go with two issues originally, but you only had space for it in the December one. But I mean, I started writing that one around about the June, so it took me about 5 months to write it, you know, and we had to get it in by the end of the year, which is why it suddenly appeared in the December one, because I was quite late. I'm terrible with deadlines. I'm a bit like Douglas Adams. I love deadlines. They make a lovely whooshing sound as they go past. You know? I'm very like that, I must admit. I still have articles now thinking about it. Never mind. But it took me a long time to write it. And I think But he'd forgotten that it was the anniversary even. And I sort of said, well, it's 1967. It's 2017 now, as was. Mm. Of course, yes, so it is. And so the biggest cryptozoology thing, even though it's in the height of the cryptozoology flap, mm. you know, sort of like the teens was the very big cryptozoology on TV, et cetera,
yeah.
Finding Bigfoot did a special on it because they went back to Bluff Creek.
Mm.
But that's pretty much it. You'd think there'd be more. So I think it'd be interesting to see what does happen with Rendlesham. The fact it happened over here makes a difference, obviously, because it's our homegrown one, isn't it? It's our yes. biggest one, really.
Yes.
But it'd be interesting to see what he's made of it, or whether it just like gets swept away and just like, oh, whatever, mm. you know. Yeah, it's going to be interesting.
It is. And it's a case, like I say, because it exploded at that cusp of as discovering the wonderful world of the Fortean, you know, that late yeah. 70s, early 80s period, which I think is responsible for getting most people of our generation into it, but on both sides of the Atlantic, because obviously those yeah. guys had in search of the original series as well.
And we had good artwork and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And some wonderful Bigfoot documentaries that I've recently been rewatching again, like the Mystery Monsters and things like that, where you've got interviews with DeGandon and Sanderson and John Green and people like that. You're just like, goodness me.
These people actually spent their time out in the woods. You know yeah. what I mean? It's that's the big difference, isn't it? It's like, I was having a discussion a while back with somebody about, you know, it was Rich Freeman a while back.
Yeah.
And we were talking about it. So I'm writing something at the moment about the general state of cryptozoology. And I spoke to Lauren Coleman and Carl Shuker, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And I was talking to Rich Freeman about this. He said, well, the big difference is, he said, you've got people who've got really expensive TV cameras mm. who go approximately a mile and a half into the woods and make a lot of noise for 6 hours and photograph a cow and then each other and a deer. Mm. And then they come out. So I really take the piss out of it in one of the FTs about finding Bigfoot, especially. I really rip into it a bit unfairly in some ways, because everywhere's squatchy, isn't it? Oh, this place is squatchy. It's like, oh God, here we go again. You know, it's really, we got no evidence, but it's really squatchy. Somebody saw something in 1968. It was over there. Let's go and wait over there. It'll turn up again, you know, obviously.
Yeah.
Rich said, if you make all this noise, they're not going to show up. People like DeHinden and Green and stuff, and Rich himself,
yeah.
go into the bloody woods. They go deep in the woods. They spend months deep in the bloody woods, quietly waiting in the hope that they'll see something. And they're the people you listen to, because they're, you know, obviously, we can. There's some people we can discount because they go on about how much time they spend in the bloody woods. you know, but there's other people. I mean, like Adam Davis has just come back from Alaska. He just spent like, you know, quite a long time, and I'm really interested to see what he does. Unfortunately, his stuff's all on US TV.
Yes.
And a lot of people doesn't get over here, does it?
No.
So I'm hoping to have a chat with him about what he caught. But he sounds like he caught some interesting stuff in Alaska, which would be quite, you know. Because Adam's he's unsensational.
Yes.
And it's like, well, like Les Stroud as well. Les Stroud is, you know, people, oh, yeah. But he spends his time out there. It's him and a camera.
Mm.
That's it. You know, the guy's not sensational. The stuff he's seen, the stuff he's heard, he's not saying it is a Bigfoot, but he's going to go and see if he can find one.
Yeah.
That's brilliant, you know.
Mm.
He's not turning up in an SUV with a bunch of, like, you know. It always makes me laugh in finding Bigfoot. I'm going to go off on my own. He said, and they're walking 10 feet in front of the camera, talking about how they're on their own. You know what? Who's taking the bloody film? You know what I mean? It's like, who are you trying to kid?
Yeah.
It's like, it's marvellous. Don't get me started on mountain monsters, because I'll be here all night.
Yeah.
But it's like, you know, but things like that are the tail end, aren't they? They're, it was proof that the thing was starting to cave in on itself as cryptozoology. Because it will go quiet now for another 10 years. And then it'll start to build up again in about 10, 15 years.
Yeah.
And come 2040, it'll be the in thing again.
Yeah.
It's just the way it works.
It is interesting as well, because obviously, like I say, it's my biggest love in the world of the weird. And I've noticed that all the quality has gone on the internet for cryptozoology. So they've basically, you know, you've got, there's a brilliant guy in Canada called Justin Chernopleski. Apologies, Justin, if I pronounce your name wrong again. Who works under Mountain Beast Mysteries, and he's basically done three films, self-funded films.
Yes.
And his film was the first, I think his second film, which was Hunt for the Wild Man. He interviewed the world champion taxidermist. I never knew, realized there was such a thing until I watched this. Ken Walker, who is just about to appear in a new documentary about Bigfoot called Big Fur, which is just about to come out. And Ken is one of the most compelling witnesses I've ever heard interviewed on Bigfoot. He's absolutely spellbinding. I recommend it. It's free to watch on YouTube if you've never seen it.
No, please send me the link later, please. I will.
And he's made a couple, and obviously you've got Small Town Monsters in the States who are doing some really good stuff. There's a couple of really good Yowie documentaries due out in the next month or so from Oz, which I think's long overdue as well. So
yeah, the Yowie's overlooked a bit, isn't it? And that's the thing, the Yowie, because again, Gates went to look for the Yowie, didn't he?
Yes.
Well, I think Rich has been out there looking for it.
Yes,
as well.
He has. Yeah, Rich. Yeah. I think he's had a couple of trips down to Australia to go Yowie hunting.
But again, it's just perfect territory, isn't it? It's vast, vast uninhabited stuff, effectively. And but again, there's an awful lot of folklore that leads up to it. And this is something that Rich hit upon, wasn't it, when he talked about the Orang Pendek, about the importance of folklore. Because people go, oh, yeah, but they don't know what they're looking at. Well, that's the point. They know exactly what they're bloody looking at.
Yeah.
It's their flaw and flaw. They're not sensational about it. It's part of the thing. And what's his name? Thomas Seward, the guy who is based in Vancouver, Native American, Sasquatch Island, I think that's him. Yeah. And he always says, look, you know, in the folklore, they are an animal. Yep. They're part of the fauna. They're not some mythical beast.
Yep.
They're not some mystical animal. They're like a bear or a wolf or a moose. They're another animal. They're slightly different because they're a bit more like us.
Yeah.
But that's what they are. We don't see them as this great god, you know. It's in his words, it's white people who think that it's something different. It's not, you know. But it's a lot cleverer and it hides really well, and that's the whole point. And I think the same with Yowies, because Aboriginals, absolutely, yeah, of course they are. There they are. They're over there. You can go and find them if you want to go and find them. We've got no interest in going to find them anymore. We've got interest in finding koalas. Yeah. So well, off you go. It's like, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I've always found that aspect interesting, that when it's used as a dismissal, it's always held up as, oh, well, it's folklore, but everything else is okay.
Yeah.
So
exactly.
Hang on, how does that work then? Just because you think it doesn't exist, therefore they thought it didn't exist, but clearly.
Well, it's just something else. We've said time again, isn't it? It's basically until something is lying on a slab in front of somebody with a white coat, it doesn't exist, and that's it. You know, there can be however much anecdotal evidence until a scientist, unfortunately, can stand there and go, it's real, then it's not real. And that's all there is to it.
Yeah.
And we keep coming close. Like Brian Sykes came very, very close. I mean, his discovery about Yana, the wild one, was fantastic. You know, that's that in itself. The fact she wasn't an Almasty is beside the bloody point.
Yeah.
You know, the mystery all in herself. But in a way, it was dismissed that way, wasn't it? Because, oh, no, it's not an Almasty. She just happens to be, you know, a misplaced person from sub-Saharan Africa.
Yeah.
How the hell did she get? Oh, never mind. She's not an Almasty. We're not bothered.
Yes.
That's fake, you know. I mean, Almasty, another one, like Rich, again, Rich has said, and like Carl Shook has said, they're among the most likely, because the local the local nomads totally accept them.
Yeah.
You say, we see them, they're off in the distance, we know they're there, they know we're there, we just leave each other alone, and that's it. You know, and that's it. They don't, you know, Orang Pendek, yeah, it's there, it's still the sugar cane.
Yeah.
It's what it does.
I mean, it's interesting as well, because you can use that comparison, probably the most famous cryptid in Africa, which is Makole Mbembe.
Yeah.
That is exactly the same situation, that the natives, as far as they're concerned, the locals in that particular area, are completely fully aware of every piece and every animal in that locality. And when they were shown the books, they picked them out. So what, you know, because I've seen things where people say, oh yeah, we've got mermaids and they're sunfish, and they go, no, they're sunfish. Oh, here it is, and you know it's a sunfish, you know, or a manatee or something like that, Stu. So it frustrates me that they're allowed to be right about everything else, and we know throughout history, you know, gorillas were thought to be a folkloric creature, pandas were until somebody shot one. You know, these creatures are, you know, The local people are clearly uneducated simpletons. However, they seem to know every other animal they come across.
Exactly, they can accurately identify them. And again, you sort of say, people go, well, yes, but it's a bit, you know, the only animals are left to discover are insects and stuff. And then, like in Vietnam, they found an entire bloody ox in Vietnam. It's like, it's one of my favourite misnomers about Bigfoot. It's the one who, oh, there's nothing for it to eat. Well, hang on. cougars, moose, bears, wolves, they all manage perfectly well.
Yeah.
So what is it about Bigfoot? I mean, is it sort of the lack of, I don't know, does it need sushi or something?
Well, that's probably why it likes salmon.
It isn't. It kind of gets to a local branch of Aldi or something. It's kind of like, what does it need that those don't?
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, there's a very famous Bigfoot story from Canada where a Bigfoot took a fancy to a barrel of salted fish. So it may.
Yes. In the 40s, remember that? Yeah.
Yeah. So the fish and Bigfoot are synonymous. But that is the other thing, because if you want to do a side-by-side comparison, the most likely animal in North America is obviously a bear. And we know how big bears get. We know how far they can go.
Yeah.
What they eat.
Exactly.
I mean, it's not beyond the realms of comprehension. On a dietary basis, because at the end of the day, we haven't got one. We've never seen one having food. We don't know what they eat. Everybody sort of assumes, I think.
Yeah, there's been one report of them digging up marmots, wasn't there, and eating marmots. And there was berries, elderberries, when, what's his name, the guy, what's his name, the very famous one. His name slipped my mind.
Osman.
Osman, yes, because he described, obviously, because he was kidnapped by them for a week, yes. Which is, I don't know whether he helped that along a little bit or not.
Yeah.
We're never going to know.
Very true.
But again, his descriptions were very, very, very good and very detailed. And it's something John Napier picks up on, doesn't he? Mm. And John Napier, being basically an anatomist, picked up on all the details. Nothing about Osman actually, he says he's not sure he believes him, but he said that he was kidnapped for a week. But he does concede that he's pretty certain he saw something up close and a family of them up close for a considerable amount of time to make that detailed a description. And it's not something he could have come up with on his own. Yeah. You know, it's amazing stuff, isn't it? You know.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of my favourite old Bigfoot stories. That and the Bauman case, where Bauman's campmate gets smashed to pieces by an angry one. is one of those stories that's always stayed with me. And I was I've noticed over the last couple of years there seems to be this kind of returning towards, because I think Bigfoot's been kind of classed as this cuddly friendly thing just chilling out in the woods. He's that, you know, they're pretty cool, they just want to stay on their own, you know, need their own space, that they're just needing time. But I've noticed recently that there seems to be a tendency towards more aggressive encounters coming back into the popularity, which I found an interesting trend.
Yeah, so they've you're right, they've had the sort of the Big Lebowski sort of image for a while, haven't they? They're just cool, they're chilling, they're doing their thing. Yeah. Just stay, I'm doing my da-da-da. But yeah, they start hearing about things like Hanobia and so forth, and you know, are they actually? One of my favourite Finding Bigfoot episodes was the one in Kentucky, Moonshine, Bigfoot and Moonshine, I think it's called. And they go to this house, this shack, isn't it, in the middle of a clearing, surrounded by forest and a valley. And every single night they come out and they have a go at our house and so forth and so on. And they go every single night, they do it every single night to this house, and they blockade and they loads of them, they do this stuff. They go, oh, that's good. Okay, we're going to go 15 miles down the road and stand. He's like, why don't you stay there for the night and film it? See what happened? No, they go somewhere else altogether. Oh. And that really, that one kind of boggled my mind a little bit. Why did they do that?
Yes,
you know,
absolutely.
You know, the aggression though does seem to have if you're on their territory. Mm. As you were saying, that, you know, the paranormal witness one we mentioned, the guy gets basically chased away from the territory. Mm. It's their territory, you know. But a lot of animals are like that. Yeah. They're not gonna chase you until you get home. They're not gonna break into your house. Yeah. They just want you off their, you know, you're in their garden. It's what Billy Connolly said about sharks, isn't it? Yeah. He said, sharks aren't nasty, evil bastards. He said, you're in their living room.
Yeah.
Human beings got no business being in the sea. Yeah. We don't belong there. They do belong there. They're perfectly justified to take a bite out of you if you wander into their living room. That's what happens, you know. And it's probably the same with Bigfoot, to be honest. They are aggressive, yeah. But if you start cutting down all their trees, they're going to start chucking the odd log at you. And that's the way to look at it, I think. yeah. if they exist.
Absolutely, of course. I mean, Ape Canyon's another prime example of the angry early 20th century Bigfoot, because obviously that's a fantastic. And I know there's a guy in America called Mark Marcel who's done a load of research, and he's found loads of historical documents about the family giving up their claim and stuff. It's very interesting, really tantalising stuff he uncovered.
Oh, God, yeah, absolutely. I mean, and again, because it's Fred Beck, isn't it?
Yes.
Because one of them shot and possibly killed one of them, didn't they?
Mm.
So, I mean, but then again, you get this thing about Bigfoot being invulnerable to gunfire, which is, you start to get the mystical stuff with it. But I think that, this has been used, they're invulnerable to gunfire, but grizzlies are as well. I mean, a lot of people have said you need a machine gun to take down a grizzly. You know, unless you're a very lucky shot, they are unbelievable. And a Bigfoot could be just the same, you know. You're still going to injure the things, but all you're going to do is really annoy them if you only shoot them once. You know what I mean? Absolutely. You need a hat to take them down, basically.
Yeah, big time. I mean, the prime example I always, it still takes my breath away sometimes, Stu, when I see a nature documentary and I see a polar bear taking down a walrus. Because you just think, right, and a human person who, you know, I once saw a documentary called, strangely enough, When Animals Attack, and it was a lady in Alaska who had been to a party, and she was walking home down the street, and a polar bear jumped on her from behind and shook her by her head. She survived, and I think she had 200 stitches, and she survived because her friend started banging the bins, and it startled it a little, and she managed to crawl away with like half a scalp hanging off. And you just think, good Lord.
I don't know. They're amazing. Well, you read the sort of thing, especially about strength and so on. One of the often cited bits of evidence, isn't it, about what's been done to branches. And obviously you hear about branches being sort of tipped over to make like wigwam branches and stuff like that. Mm. But it's the ones I find brilliant, the ones that have twisted, where they've taken a branch and twisted it.
Yeah.
So the strength to do that is phenomenal.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You, a human being, there's no way any human being can do that.
Yeah.
And it's 8 feet off the ground as well.
Mm.
Who can reach up and do that? Nobody can bloody do that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's kind of, it's all this stuff. I mean, you think about how strong chimps are. Chimps are sort of five times stronger than a human being, aren't they?
Yeah.
A gorilla is supposed to be 10 times stronger. I think something that's 1.5 times the size of a gorilla, is it going to be 15 times stronger than we are? You know, for God's sake, they are colossally strong if they exist. They're taking it, taking it for read that they do. Especially they spend all their time climbing about.
Yeah.
You know, they're amazing creatures. And I think I mean, I imagine you're the same as me. You're not expecting anybody to find them, but you hope that they do.
Oh, absolutely. 100%. I mean, it is one of those interesting things because when it comes to, you know, bipedal cryptids, you know, we've mentioned them, and I think the only one we've not touched on is probably the Yeren as well, the Chinese one. There's basically like a top five where it basically moves around where I've got usually Orang Pendex number one, and I think that's probably the one. If we're going to find one of them first, I think it's going to be that. And then I'm told
he'll be rich as well. Rich will find it. He's not going to give up. You know, now he don't watch Doctor Who anymore. He'll be straight out there. No problem whatsoever.
Absolutely. So you got them. And I think it's a tie between the Yowie and the Almasty for me.
Yes, I think you're right. I think Bigfoot, if it exists, I hope it does.
Yeah.
It might be extinct. It might be seeing ghosts of the thing. I don't know.
Well, why not?
Yeah, exactly. It could all be an infrasound thing again, couldn't it?
Mm.
It could be that people are just picking up on what they saw. But, yeah, who knows? If they find one, then it's kind of mitigating that there's going to be others.
Mm.
You know, and that's the way to look at it. And I think, you know, if it does turn out to be a relic Gigantopithecus, that's fine. It could be a relic hominid, which is bigger. It could be all kinds of things. I mean, Denisovans, people, I was reading a thing about genetics not so long ago. Mm-hmm. They're talking about the Denisovan people and stuff like that. And we've only got evidence of a couple of them.
Yeah.
And we know they're quite big. They know they're probably on average bigger than we are.
Mm-hmm.
But for all we know, those could be teenagers. The adults could be 7 foot tall, for all we know.
Yeah.
The problem with the fossil record is that an archaeologist friend of mine put it very, very neatly. She explained it as being, she said, look, it's like a jigsaw puzzle where we don't know how many pieces there are.
Mm.
We don't know what the original picture looks like. And what we've got is one corner piece, a couple of edges, and a load of mess in the middle.
Yeah.
We have no idea how big the thing is. You know, we don't know what we don't know. So we can only go scientifically on what we have got.
Yeah.
So we can only make, but we can only make sort of certain assumptions about Denisovans, about Neanderthals. There could be dozens of other species of human and ape that we never knew about. Well, and that's what, you know.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, 25 years ago, there were two.
Yeah.
Homo sapiens and Neanderthal. And that was it.
Yeah. Exactly.
And we've what? We've discovered four definite new ones with, you know, we've got obviously, you know, Far East Asia seems to be like a melting pot of these discoveries at the minute. You know, it's incredible.
Yeah, that's the other thing, because I mean, apparently the climate and the soil is very good, especially in the Philippines and sort of Borneo, Sumatra. It's very, very good for preserving stuff, but you've got nowhere to dig. Yeah. And that's the thing. A lot of these things could be buried under massive trees, for all we know.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of, if again, my archaeologist friend said, for all you know, you can be digging 5 feet away from the biggest possible discovery on the planet. You would never know because your trench is 5 feet away from it. You know, look at Richard III found under a car park.
Yeah.
That's all the thing. Only by luck.
Yeah.
You know, it's until something might turn up in the fossil record, or we might find a live one. Who knows?
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, we just see it with dinosaurs even today, Stu. I think 20 years ago to what we know now, our understanding of dinosaurs in general is completely different, as well as the fact that it seems to be near enough every week we discover a brand new species.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's just, no, you know, we're very lucky. Yeah, you get lucky and you find something. You could, I mean, the archaeology's moved on, as far as I know, paleontology's moved on to the degree that they can make good predictions about where they're going to find stuff.
Yeah.
But then you've got all kinds of problems because it might be somewhere that you can't dig. Mm. It might be all sorts of reasons you can't dig there. It might be that there are strata underneath the current surface, which would be easy, you know, which would be good for fossils. You don't know there's fossils there, and you might have to shift thousands of tons of rock to get at those strata. You know, it's kind of, is it economically viable to look for something which might not even be there? And again, it's just, but then this on a sort of terrestrial scale, then comes the same argument about hunting for cryptids. Who's going to pay for it? We haven't got the Tom Slicks anymore who will give $1 million to someone to spend 6 months. You know, it has to be an academic thing, doesn't it, really?
Yeah, absolutely. Sadly, though I have promised Peter Byrne, if I do win the lottery, I will be investing a large portion of it into Bigfoot research. So that's my promise for that. So listen, Stu, it's been wonderful having a chance to have a really good conversation about a variety of wonderful and weird things. So thank you for coming with me wherever we've gone.
That's all right. No problem. We touched upon Bigfoot glitter and carp swimming formation. And that's not a conversation I ever thought I'd have in an hour with someone, to be honest. So there we go.
Absolutely. With added UFOs as well, Stu. Why not?
Everything is there. Everything is there.
So listen, where can everybody keep up to date, catch your work, or join the 40 in Times and find out more?
Get on the 40 on the forums. We now come under the CFI, so we're now under the Charles Fort Institute. We cut loose from the 40 in Times pushing 18 months ago now, because the publishers refused to pay for our upkeep. Yeah. However, they were gracious enough to take the database and the forums with us. So we come under the CFI now.
Yep.
So it's under Gordon Rutter and myself are the ones who run it. So we're responsible for it. So we're even more careful than we used to be when Dennis was running it.
Yes.
Get yourselves on the 14 forums. Come in, have a chat. Everybody's welcome.
Brilliant. Well, listen, Stu, thank you once again for your chat today. It's been a really good conversation and thoroughly texted my my brain and my mind on several subjects. So thank you very much for joining me.
No problem at all. Hope to do it again soon. Take care.